Welcome to Street Hypnosis. This is session 2 of the masterclass entitled How to Really Use NLP for Amazing Results. Now, in the first session, we had looked at the foundational concepts that are the underpinnings of all of NLP. We looked at the things that make NLP work, the insights and understandings, and also we looked at how NLP views the world, how it looks at people, which in turn allows us to evolve the techniques that come out of NLP. Now, in today's session, what I want to focus on is the linguistic element of neuro-linguistic programming. Language is a really important part of a hypnosis session, of an NLP session, and really of any kind of interaction. And one of the gifts that NLP brought to the table is a way of looking at language, which is both simple to grasp and easy to use and very influential, actually very powerful. Now, before we look at some of the more, if you like, convoluted ideas around language and use of language, the starting point I want to begin with today is on presuppositions. Now, presupposition is basically a linguistic assumption. It's something that has to be true in order for a sentence that you hear to make sense. Now, I'd like to read you a little quote here from Aldous Huxley's The Doors of Perception. And this is a very insightful look at the human condition and particularly of what language does for us as human beings. So in The Doors of Perception, Aldous Huxley says that every individual is at once the beneficiary and the victim of the linguistic traditions into which he has been born. He's the beneficiary in as much as language gives access to the accumulated record of other people's experience. He's the victim insofar as it confirms him in the belief that reduced awareness is the only awareness, and it bedevils his sense of reality, so that he's all too apt to take his concepts, in other words, his ideas, for data, his words for actual things. Now, this is very important, because this basically underpins much of the philosophy behind NLP and the reason why a lot of the linguistic aspects of the techniques have been created. And in my opinion, by the way, the linguistic elements that NLP has to offer are the most elegant. It's not the techniques and it's not all these other things. So looking at that, we need to start thinking about how people use presuppositions to basically trap their minds, trap their thinking, in order to be able to start understanding how we can use the things that NLP shows us in order to release those traps. And those traps, again, happen in all walks of life, not just in therapeutic or coaching settings. In a sales process, someone might think he wants something and is looking for entirely the wrong product. It is, as a lawyer, it happened to me all the time that we'd talk to a client who asked for a particular kind of legal service or a particular kind of contract or thing to occur. And really, he wanted something completely different. He needed something completely different. It's just that he thought, this does that, and that is what I want. And he asks you for what he thinks he wants, rather than for what he really wants. So what presuppositions do is they trap your thinking, a little bit like the Wimbledon game. Let me give an example of the Wimbledon game. Some of you may have heard this before. Imagine that we are playing in the famous Wimbledon tennis championships, and the tennis championships are based on a simple knockout tournament, which is basically, you know, if 100 people play, then you all pair up, you know, the winners go through the next round, they play each other, the winner goes through the next round, etc., etc., until there's a final match, and then the winner, of course, is the clear winner. Now, of course, every other round, there's going to be an odd number of people. So when there's an odd number of people, say there's a round with 99 people playing, one person has no partner to play against. And the way they resolve this difficulty is, of course, to let the player just have a bye, so that he goes back to the next round and the next round again. When it's even, you can carry on playing. So here's the question. How many matches need to be played in order for a clear winner to emerge? So for a Wimbledon champion to emerge. Any ideas, Sean?
No.
Okay. So the traditional way people try and solve this is several ways. Either they start making mental pictures of all the different, you know, championships that have to be played and the matches that have to be played, and then start ticking them off and adding them up. Another way people start trying to do this, a little bit more sophisticated, a little bit more difficult, is to try and create a formula to figure out what's the mathematical formula that will allow you to predict the result. I'm going to ask you the same question again. I'm going to change the presupposition in the question and it's going to instantly let your mind escape thought trap that the implications, the presuppositions in my original question have placed on you. And you'll, by the way, know the answer instantly. So there's 999 people going into the championship. How many people need to lose a match before there's a clear winner?
998.
Exactly right. So there's got to be 998 matches played. Why? Because everyone only gets to lose a match once. And everyone has to lose a match once in order to be a clear winner. So once everyone has lost the match, the only person who has never lost a match, whether he's got a bye or not, is irrelevant. He's the clear winner. So notice how, just by phrasing the question a little differently, I've actually made it totally easy to answer the question. In other words, I've released your thinking from a trap. Now this is what presuppositions do to us. They simultaneously can trap our thinking, but they can also trap our thinking in a positive way. In other words, we can trap people's thinking in towards a solution. We can also trap people's thinking towards problems. And there's many different kinds of presuppositions. I want to run you through a few of them in order to sensitize you to them. Now, this is not to say this is an exclusive list, by no means at all. It's just that we want to look at different styles that exist out there just so that you begin to spot them in your day-to-day interactions, and people use these all the time. So let's begin with the first one, which would be called existence. Basically, a presupposition of existence presupposes, it implies, that something exists. If I say the chair is in the room, what am I implying? That there's a chair there, and that a room exists. So the chair is in the room implies both that chairs exist and that the room exists, and otherwise the whole sentence does not make sense. So pretty much any sentence you hear will presuppose existence, because the very fact they're mentioning something is usually because it's in existence. I'm meeting my friend. Well, I'm presupposing that first of all I exist, that I have a friend, and that he also exists. I'm meeting my friend in a coffee shop. That is a coffee shop somewhere. So it's a very simple presupposition, but be careful of this one because there are some interesting things you can start doing with this, which we'll explore a little later on. The second presupposition is the presupposition of awareness. In this one, basically, you're going to take control of people's attention just by directing it, by talking about something that they may or may not have been aware of before. For example, I'm not sure if you're aware of the temperature in your left foot right now. But notice how just by mentioning it, you have to put your awareness there. And if I mention that your shoulders could either be relaxed or tense, chances are you will put your awareness on your shoulders to check whether or not they are. So just by putting your awareness on something, rather by mentioning something, I'm directing your awareness towards us. Now this is very useful for us, particularly as hypnotists. Why? Because just by using presuppositions of awareness, for example, notice, see, hear, feel, become aware of, sense, these words basically allow us to take control of someone else's awareness. And of course, attention is the first rung in the hypnosis ladder. Remember, to create a hypnotic state, you need to do ABS. You need to absorb someone's attention, bypass the critical factor, and then you need to stimulate the unconscious mind. Presuppositions of awareness are beautiful because they, by definition, capture awareness. Next, the third style of presupposition that I would like you to become sensitized to are modal operators. Now, there's basically two types of modal operators. One is necessity, and one is possibility or impossibility, depending on if it's phrased negatively. Basically, a modal operator, whether of necessity or of possibility, implies that either something needs to be done or that something is possible. So necessity is implied by words like I need to, we should, you must, you have to do this, we really ought to do this. Those are all words that imply necessity, need. And simultaneously, or in the same way, words that imply possibility or impossibility are things like I can, I'm able to, you will, you want to, you could, you can't. Okay, moving on to the fourth type is temporal. Now, basically temporal implies time, that the time exists and that the time flows in a particular way. Now, temporal presuppositions can be broken down into all kinds of different subsets. You can have a change of time, like I'm here already. Basically, already just saying that as time is changing, I've You already arrived. In other words, you're implying that something happened beforehand. You can simply change tenses. You know, I am a young man when I was a young man. So when I was a young man implies that you're no longer young. You have conditional time. If John becomes a fireman, the if suggests that it hasn't happened yet, or when John becomes a fireman. This is how these both are implying things about the future. One is a possible future and one is a less likely future. So using certain presuppositions like if, when, as well as change of tenses, allows you to control time or people's perception of time. Linked to this and very closely related to this is the presupposition, the ordinal presuppositions. This is the fifth group in the category. Ordinal presupposition basically, instead of implying time, just implies sequence, an order of events. So if I say to you, first thing we're going to do is look at presuppositions, I'm implying to you that there's going to be a second thing we're going to do and a third thing. So you know that other things are coming. If I start in the middle, if I started this masterclass, this particular session, by saying, the third thing you should know about NLP, your minds will start scrambling, going, hang on a second, what are the first two things? Did we do the first two things in the first session, or what's it referring to? So ordinal presuppositions, again, be very powerful. They're introduced by words like before, earlier than, ahead of, first, second, third, that kind of thing. Next, and sixth in the row in the group, we have binds. Some people like to call these double binds, but actually a bind is a more appropriate term than a double bind, because there's no double actually in a double bind. In essence, a bind is where you don't give one an out. You know the old saying, be caught between a rock and a hard place, are stuck no matter what you do. It's jumping out of a frying pan into the fire is another example of a metaphorical version of a bind. So if I say to you, you would like to sign this contract now or later, as long as you don't break the bind, in other words, you say, I don't want to sign it at all, you're stuck. It's just a question of when you're going to do it. Have you experienced hypnosis before right now? Notice how, however you answer that question, it's implying that you will be going to trance. You're just bound to that outcome. Whether you experienced it before, you're going to have it now. Whether you haven't experienced until this point, you're going to have it now. So double binds usually are presented in a way that you can basically, what's called, use an exclusive or an inclusive or. Basically, you're giving people a pseudo choice. We like to do this or that. And really, both of them end up doing the same thing. The next kind of presupposition is a simple cause-effect. Basically, you're presupposing that something is causing something else. So, you know, as soon as you close your eyes, you'll be feeling much more comfortable. Well, we're now implying that closing your eyes is going to somehow cause comfort. It may not actually be true, but the implication has a lot of power. The next one is a presuppositions called complex equivalence. This, again, this is very powerful. It's similar to the cause-effect one, only this time, rather than implying that something is causing something else, you're implying that they're pretty much the same thing, right? So when I say that ice cream is cold, I'm really implying that ice cream and cold basically are the same quality. You know, he is a cold person. I'm implying that cold character and that person are basically the same thing. So when you want to know what a cold character is, you look at that person. When you look at that person, you'll know what a cold character is, because they're one and the same thing in many ways. So now we come on to the ninth type of presupposition that I want you guys to just pay attention to. And just notice this little list is just basically getting you used to what other people are using all the time, what you yourself are using all the time, without really realizing it. And we'll look at why this is important in a moment. So turning back to the ninth presupposition, this is comparison. So in comparison, you're basically comparing things or you're implying things whilst diverting attention from the main idea or the main suggestion. For example, if you loved me as much as you love your work, then we'd be okay, we'd have a great relationship. You're diverting attention away from the relationship in many ways because caught in a kind of bind. They can't say that they love you more than their work because, you know, you already get them trapped in that thought stream. The next kind of bind is repetition. Basically, you're implying that things have happened before. Typically, you can do this with the prefix RE to a word. So he returned. He re-engaged in conversation. I want to have a rematch. Notice how all these things are implying that there's been a match before, that there's a conversation before, that he was in a place before. This can also be implied, of course. Repetition can also be implied by words like again. Again, of course, is saying the same thing. I want another match, I want to have a match with you again. It's the same as saying I want a rematch. So you can imply that something's happened before when you're going to repeat the activity just by prefixing with the word the little letters RE, or by adding words like again or once more or a second time, etc. Now, do you get the basic 10 types of presuppositions and kind of get a sense of where they come from, and others, how they fit into the scheme of natural conversations that people have every day?
Yeah, sure.
Any questions about those or any one of those categories? Let me just recap them very quickly just so you have them clear in your mind. So we're talking about existence, awareness, modal operators, both necessity and possibility, temporal time, ordinal, in other words, a sequence, binds and double binds. We have cause-effect, we have a complex equivalence, comparisons, and repetition. So you get all those types of presuppositions?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
And any questions on those?
No, not really.
Okay, so now you may as well keep yourself in line because we're going to do a quick exercise. I'm going to read you a bunch of statements, and all I want you to do is pull out what is implied in those statements. Now, I don't mind if you can label the type of presupposition. If you can, that's even better. For the moment, I'm actually happy that you're beginning to analyze a statement for the presuppositions built into it. Okay?
Sure.
So the first statement is, if he says that again, I will hit him. So
the presupposition is that he has said something before.
Exactly. So the basic presupposition is he said something before. Okay?
Yeah.
There are other presuppositions, of course. I mean, you can have existence, like the fact that you exist, that he exists, that a statement, previous statement exists, etc. You can talk about time. In other words, as a future action, I will hit him. And then there's an implication that there might be a future interaction with that person. But the basic one is he said something before. Right. The next one. The next thing to do is to whip up the egg. Like a nice instructions for an omelette.
The basic implication there is that there was something before that.
Exactly. So there's a step that there's a step in the recipe that we've missed. So if you tune into a TV set to a cooking channel that says the next thing to do is to whip up the egg, you know that you've missed some of the steps, right? Of course, there's all kinds of other presuppositions like the fact that eggs exist and you know that you have to whip the egg. There's an implication of a modal operator of necessity. But the basic one again is just the ordinal presupposition. You know, I really had a crush on her.
Basic one there is that you don't anymore.
Exactly. So what we're implying is, of course, that there was a time when there was a crush, so we've got a time of thing going on, but it's no longer the case. So that, first of all, the emotion is gone and the time has moved on since. How about he moved to the front of the room?
The presupposition is that he was at the back of the room. Or somewhere that wasn't the front of the room.
Exactly. By using things like presupposition of awareness, we're bringing your attention to the front of the room, and possibly even for some people to the back of the room, given that front implies that there is a back, but not necessarily for all people. Okay? Let's try a couple of other ones. Shyness is caused by fear.
So that's a... Well, presupposing that there are things such as shyness and fear.
Sure.
And there's a there's a presupposition that one is caused by the other, I suppose.
Perfect. So there's a cause-effect there.
One has to come before the other.
Exactly. So there's a simple cause-effect there. It's not saying that shyness causes fear, but that fear causes shyness. It's actually very blatantly stated there, isn't it? His smile made her feel weak.
That she wasn't feeling weak before he smiled. One presupposition.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Now you're thinking on those lines. Carry on.
There would be the presupposition that he did something, so he smiled, so before he wasn't smiling.
Mm-hmm.
And there would be a cause-effect again.
Exactly. Perfect. Now I'm glad to hear that your mind is beginning to get sensitized to these things, because this is exactly where we want to be heading with this. Now, let's try. Notice the film beginning to grow over the top of the liquid.
So there's a presupposition of awareness, which is notice.
Mm-hmm.
As though the person, as though it's happening, but the person just needs to notice it happening.
Mm-hmm.
So growing would be a time-based presupposition. So it's actually it's growing, so it's not suddenly there. It is taking its time to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that the so was it the film
notice
the
notice the film beginning to grow over the liquid.
So that the liquid was there before the film.
Perfect.
Began to grow over it. Yeah.
We've also got an implication in terms of that it's incomplete. It's beginning to grow. It hasn't finished yet. And of course, there's an ordinal thing there as well. Okay, so there's a whole bunch of other implications. If you look at your manual under the presuppositions exercises, you'll have a whole bunch of others. I'm going to encourage you to, in your own time, read through those and keep going on along the same lines. I think you've got the essence of it now. So it's ready to move on to the next exercise. The next exercise is important. Why? Because remember, we talked about that a presupposition is a linguistic assumption. It's something that language assumes to be true, because without it being true, the sentence just won't make sense, right? However, something called a mind read as well. In other words, very often people will read into someone's statement, not something that has to be true in order for it to make sense. In other words, a truly assumed event, but they'll read all kinds of other things into it that may or may not be true. In other words, it could be plausible, and it's probably more likely to be true than not, but given that statement on its own, you don't actually know whether it's true. Does this make sense?
Yeah.
So we're going to do a quick exercise now to be able to differentiate between a presupposition and a mind read. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read out a statement again like I did a moment ago, only this time I'm going to give you a series of choices, and this is information that I'll have extrapolated from that statement. Some of them will be presuppositions, pure and simple. Some of them will be mind reads. In other words, they might be true, but they won't necessarily be true. Make sense?
Yeah, sure.
You basically are reading things into it by the way you listen to it. So let's have a look at the first one. I don't know if I should stop beating my son. I don't know if I should stop beating my son. That's the statement. Now, here are your four options, and you have to categorize them. First of all, he has a son. Is that true? Is that a presupposition or a mind read?
That's a...
Feel free to write these down, so it'll help you maybe. I don't know if I should stop beating my son.
I'd say that was a presupposition.
Absolutely. Because without him having a son, the statement just doesn't make sense, right?
Yeah.
So let's have a look at this one. He is... This part of the next extrapolation. He is a bad father, and he really should be shot.
I would say that was a mind read.
I would agree with you. Okay. Now, one of the reasons, for example, is that we don't know what he's talking about. So try this one on for size, then, which is that the father has been violent towards his son.
Then that's a presupposition.
Really?
I would say.
Well, let me complete the sentence. Let me rephrase the same statement as I said a moment ago, and I'll add some missing information. Okay. I don't know if I should stop beating my son at chess.
Well, so that's a mind read.
Exactly. Well, actually, you are actually right. What it does do is it demonstrates very nicely the use of ambiguity, right? So sometimes the interpretation you took on the word beating caused a presupposition to come out, right? And you had the correct presupposition. Yours needs to also be aware that you may need more information when there's an ambiguous term like beating that could have more than one meaning, right? This should alert you that you want to find out, basically, in what context are we talking about, right?
Right, okay.
He currently beats his son. Is that a presupposition or a mind read?
I'd say that was a presupposition.
I would say so too. And he loves his son. Presupposition or mind read?
That's a mind read.
Yeah, definitely. Let's try another one. He thought it was better to try and fail than not to try at all. He thought it was better to try and fail than not to try at all. Now, let me just ask you this. Based on that statement, would it be a mind read or a presupposition to say that he was afraid?
That'd be a mind read.
Absolutely. Would it be a presupposition or a mind read to say that he has failed?
I'll say that was a mind read again.
Absolutely. Because we don't know whether he's made an attempt yet. It's talking about the future. He thought it's better to try and fail than not to try at all. But he hasn't said anything about whether or not he's actually put this into action yet. Would it be a mind read or presupposition to say that he is big fat loser for trying to make himself better and therefore he should be shot to clean up the gene pool?
I would say that was a mind read.
I think you have it actually wrong there. I think it's a no, you're right. So let's turn to one more and then we'll move on from there. If the cat does not stop meowing, I will have to shoot it. There's a bit of a theme going on here, I think you may notice. Let's try the cat is meowing. Is that a presupposition or a mind read? Because if it does not stop, implies that it's still continuing. The cat was meowing. Is that a presupposition or a mind read?
That's a mind read, I'd say.
I would disagree. I'd say that it's a presupposition because I haven't given you a time scale on that yet. So if it's meowing now, then it was meowing a moment ago. So even though I haven't given you a time period. In other words, I can't say that he was meowing yesterday. I can't say it was meowing an hour ago. But if I can say that the cat was meowing. It has been meowing because it's still an ongoing process. Make sense? If you're in the middle of an ongoing process, then there is a past to it as well. That's the beauty of the present tense. It doesn't exist, or rather, it only exists. It's fleeting. Right, Every moment keeps moving it on. The cat will meow. Presupposition or mind read?
I would say that was a mind read.
I agree with you, because we don't know. He wants it to stop meowing, but he hasn't actually said anything about whether or not it will. He wants to shoot the cat.
I would say that was a mind read.
Absolutely. And he is a cruel man. Who should be shot.
That's a mind read again.
Absolutely right. Okay, so you get the idea now between presuppositions and mind reads and being able to distinguish between them and actually to pull out what can be presupposed by a statement and what is purely mind read or things that you put into it yourself in order to try and understand it. Now, again, in the manual, you'll find a couple more versions of that exercise that you can just test yourself on, and you can do it in your own time. It's very worthwhile getting used to presuppositions. Why is this? Well, presuppositions lie at the heart of the way that you use language. It lies at the heart of most of the NLP. In fact, one of the most elegant ways to create influence and change in people is to use presuppositions, because then you win the battle without anyone ever knowing that a war has been fought. It just basically avoids the battle altogether. Now, there's a problem with presupposition in the sense that sometimes people use them on you. They use them on you in terms of to try and keep you bound into something that you maybe don't want to do. In other words, to limit your choices. And sometimes they use them themselves to limit their own choices without knowing about it. This is typically when people have problems. Now, we're talking about not just personal problems, but problems in general. For example, someone wants to go and buy a computer. They need a computer, then they go to the store, and they really can't make up their mind which one to buy. And it may be just that they have a poor decision strategy, but it might be that they're trapped by some presuppositions that they're not aware of. In other words, they might think that a computer is too expensive, they want a reliable one, so they don't want to pay for a cheap one, and they keep bouncing between the one they want for what it is and the one they want for the price itself. And as a elegant influencer, it's your job to figure out what their presuppositions are and then burst through them so that they get to choose whether or not it's a useful place to get stuck in. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah.
Now, the interesting thing is, this is exactly where the basic seed from NLP was born. If you remember back to session one, NLP was really born when Grinder and Bandler went off and studied how two very famous therapist of this in the 70s, one called Virginia Satir, family therapist, the other one called Fritz Perls, the father of Gestalt therapy, were doing their work, and they're doing amazing work. And they discovered that the thing that they had in common, And the thing that they kept doing over and over again, just before people started changing, is that the person would say something, and then either Virginia or Fritz would turn around and it'd ask a penetrating question. And the person would say something else, and then ask another penetrating question. And they'd ask penetrating question after penetrating question until eventually something magical happened, which is to say the person had a radical shift. Their physiology shifted, their face went all through all kinds of contortions, and suddenly they had a moment of enlightenment. Suddenly they started laughing, or they felt like, wow, I know what's going on now. Basically, they started resolving their own problem. This is why Grin and Bandler thought they had it sussed. They basically figured out that people were creating problems by presupposing certain things about themselves or about the world, which were getting them stuck. So by discovering what these things were, these like violations in language that allowed them to think things were a way that they weren't, by finding out what these categories were and then finding challenges to each of these categories, they thought they had the ultimate tool for change, for therapist, for influence, etc. And in many respects, they were right. This is called the meta model. The meta model is basically a collection of, 10 or so patterns, linguistic patterns, that people use to basically get themselves stuck or get other people stuck. You've had it used on you when someone puts you in a bind, when someone kind of messes with you and you think, damn, something's happened, I have a bad taste in my mouth, I don't know why. And you end up spending the next 3 hours rerunning the same conversation, thinking about what you should have said, but even then not feeling really at ease with the whole thing. Chances are, if that's happening, you are caught by what's called a metamodal violation. So basically, the metamodal is a set of violations in language where, just like the mind read, or makes you think about something that is not necessarily the case in a presupposition, these make you think things about the world that may or may not be true. If you adopt the belief that they are true, in other words, the language is expressing this, you get trapped. Let me begin by giving you some examples of metamodal violations. Now, Sean, I'm gonna give you different categories, and I want to see if you can start spotting the pattern. Okay? If you think you've got the pattern, just let me know. So here's one category of ways that people make themselves feel bad or other people feel bad and keep them trapped or limited in some way. You make me feel bad. Because you did this, you really don't love me. I can't go today because you didn't do your work properly. He's so stupid because he's tall. I'm ugly because my nose is too big. Can you spot a pattern going on there now that you've been sensitized with your presuppositions?
Yeah, it seems to be.
Before you say the pattern, give me a few examples of a pattern before we give it a label.
I'm going to go out tonight because I want to see my friend. So one thing.
Perfect. It's a cause effect, right? It's a cause effect. So the label we give to this is called cause effect. It's purely because one thing causes this effect, right? So let's move to another category. See if you can spot this pattern. You're late. You really don't care about me. There's a ding in your car. It means you have to sell it now. You're drunk, which means you're lying to me. I'm depressed. Have you spotted a pattern in these statements?
That seems to be that one thing means another. So the fact that I'm sat here means that I want to be listening to this NLP course.
Perfect. Very good. So in NLP this is called, or in linguistics it's called, a complex equivalence. You're saying that A means B. A is equal to B. It's the same thing, right? So because it's A is equal to B, if you say that, you know, A means B, you're saying A equals B in many ways, so you call it a complex equivalence. It's the equivalent to B. A is the equivalent to having a B. Okay? Let's try another one. He doesn't like me. She doesn't even know I exist. She's afraid to work with me. He doesn't want to come. You really don't understand any of this, do you? Can you spot a pattern there?
This is like a zoom in, know what the other person feels and thinks.
Perfect. So this is known in linguistics as a mind read. I am presuming to read your mind to know what you're thinking and feeling. And I have basically deleted the evidence. Now, I might be right. For example, I might have seen a certain expression and I recognize the expression and therefore I know that you're angry with me, for example. Okay? So I may well be right, but I haven't expressed that fully. And by not expressing it fully, I might get trapped because I've forgotten where it's come from. And also, by not expressing it fully, I might not realize that I have made a mistake and that I could reevaluate my position and realize that it's not really the case at all. So what's going to happen is you're basically going to either discover information or you're going to blow out the problem because people realize that they've made a faulty conclusion. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does, yeah.
Let's try another category. You know, it's good to wait for a while. You really should look before you leap. People like you never amount to much. You can't drop out and expect to succeed. A business like that simply cannot work.
There seems to be a lack of details. So
beautiful. That's very elegant. Can you give me an example rather than describing it just now?
You know, you need to go to the supermarket. It's not saying what supermarket. It's not
perfect. Actually, it's you're right in that sense too. But the specific pattern you actually got right when you said this, which is excellent. Your unconscious mind picked it up. It's called a lost performative. Basically, we're making kind of a value judgment, but we're not saying who is creating that value judgment. You know, it's good to go to sleep early. Well, who says this? Whose opinion is that? Is that your opinion? Is that general medical opinion? What is this? Does that make sense?
Okay, sure. So it's specifically about the person and it rather than the instruction. Okay,
exactly.
Cool,
Now, the only reason I'm making that distinction is because the other side of it is a different type. It's still, you're absolutely right. You can cut these examples up into different types of pies and look at them differently linguistically, and we're going to look at that. So lost performative, the ones I gave you, are actually also examples of other things. So you can basically mix these patterns and realize that someone can say one thing and there could be maybe three or four meta-model violations in it, so you could challenge it in three or four different ways depending on where you wanted to put the emphasis. Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure.
So you're never going to get, or it's very rare that you get a clear-cut example. Usually you're going to get a kind of a mixed example, and then you just use your judgment to decide which one do you want to dive on. So lost performative basically means you've lost the performer. You've lost the person who is deciding that something's good, bad, indifferent. He's making a value judgment about what ought to happen, what can happen, what is possible, what's good, what's bad, what's indifferent, but no one's telling you what it is. Let's try a different category now. You have to listen to me. You really should do it right the first time. I ought to do it, you know. I must do better. I really need to go now. Do you think you spotted that pattern, Sean?
That something has to be done. There's no other option to it.
Perfect. So that's called a modal operator of necessity. So basically, you're saying that when you say something needs to be done, the modal operator is something that's going to adjust a statement. So I'm walking. I need to walk. Adjusting the idea of walking to make it necessary. Hence a modal operator of necessity. Okay?
Yeah, sure.
Can you give me a couple of examples?
You have to go and wash the dishes, or you must wash the car.
Perfect. So words like need to, have to, ought, should, they are your telltale signs for the modal operator of necessity. Let's look at a separate category again and see if you can spot this pattern. I can't do that. You know, you could run for office. You might have a problem with that. I really can't help myself. Just can't stop smoking. What's the pattern here?
It seems to be very similar to the above one, but rather than saying what has to be done, saying what can't be done.
Absolutely right. So rather than implying a need, this time you're implying whether or not a possibility, or in the negation sense, an impossibility, right? You're basically talking about whether or not something is possible, whereas before you're talking about whether or not something is necessary, right?
Right, okay, yeah.
So this is a modal operator of possibility as a result. Can you give me an example of it?
So something like, I can't come out for a drink tonight.
Beautiful. Excellent. Let's skip to the next meta pattern, the meta model pattern. Let's see if you can spot this one. You always criticize me. I can never get it right. You know, every time I meet someone new, she cheats on me. You always mess things up. So, have you spotted the pattern there?
So it's a big generalization of what actually likely to be the case.
Absolutely. It's a total generalization. In linguistics, it's called a universal quantifier, because you're basically turning something into a universal. Instead of saying, you know, sometimes you annoy me and sometimes you don't, you're saying you're always annoying me. So you're basically taking one situation and you're blowing it up into a universal, to saying that every situation is like this situation, right?
Right, okay, yeah.
And you're right, it's basically a generalization. It's just universal quantifier is the linguistic title. And given that you're learning neurolinguistic programming, you may as well learn the labels that go with them. But of course, the more important thing than the label is just understanding the concept and then being able to spot it, and in a moment, being able to break through the thought loop, the limitations that these patterns bring on people. Let's try this one. This is not going to be a language pattern as such, although it is in the sense that people use it, but I'm going to make it very simple in terms of just using one word at a time. Fear, anxiety, failure, depression, character, happiness, joy, enthusiasm can be used. For example, I have too much fear. I have a lot of anxiety in my life. I'm afraid of failure all the time. There is a lot of depression in my room. There's a lot of room for depression in me. My character is flawed. I can't seem to find happiness. Joy seems to be escaping me. So those words, fear, anxiety, to failure, depression, etc., what are those examples of?
Nominalizations.
Absolutely right. So a nominalization is basically something. In fact, let me ask you, what is a nominalization and how do you spot it?
Nominalization is any noun which can't fit in a wheelbarrow. So it's like a concept rather than a physical object.
And what's wrong with a nominalization?
What's wrong with one?
Linguistically speaking, I'm not making a value judgment about there's anything wrong with joy. I'm just talking about in terms of linguistics.
It's very unspecific. It's unmeasurable.
True, and there's a reason for that. And the reason for that is basically a nominalization should not be a noun. In other words, a noun is a thing like a table or a chair or a person, right? But a nominalization is something which sounds like a noun, like fear, anxiety, or happiness, or character, that really shouldn't be a noun. It's actually a verb. It's something that you do. It's not something that is. That makes sense? For example, fear is an experience. It has a beginning, it has a middle, it has an end. You move through it. It's an emotional experience. So you don't have fear. You feel fear. You feel afraid, specifically speaking, right? Same thing for depression. You don't have depression. You can't go into your local supermarket and say, I'd like to have an ounce of depression with a half a kilo of failure, please, right? Those aren't things that exist. They're things that you do. Failure doesn't exist. Failure is actually the label you put onto something when you fail. In other words, when you don't achieve a particular outcome you've set yourself. Same is true of character, happiness, joy, decisions, all these things that you actually do. You decide things, you don't have decisions. You exhibit your character, you develop your character, you grow as a human being, but people think that's a character. You experience happiness or joy, you don't have it. It's not a thing you put in your pocket and carry around with you. So that's what distinguishes a nominalization from other things. And you're right. The simple test you just ask yourself is, you know, if I had a big enough wheelbarrow, could I stick this thing into it? And if you can't find a pound of decision, then chances are it's a nominalization. Try turning into a verb, into a thing that people do. And if you can, then you suddenly realize that perhaps it is a nominalization, perhaps it should be a verb. So I cannot, for example, say, you know, I like to go and table all the time. It's like, what the hell's tabling, right? Table is a thing. Tabling doesn't exist. Make sense?
Yeah, it does, yeah.
Now, the reason that nominalizations are important, again, is because people get themselves trapped in them. They think that their fear is a real thing. They forget that it's a process. It's something that they do. It's something they do to experience the emotion of fear. Well, then there's something they can stop doing, and then they'll stop experiencing that emotion. And it's a lot easier to realize you can stop doing something that makes you feel those emotions than to think, I just have it. It's attached onto me like a suction claw, and I can't find where the claw is, and I can't stop it, because they're looking in the wrong place for the answer. Let's try this for the next language pattern, for the next metamodel pattern. I go, I'm afraid. I really hurt. You suck. You're bad. Just stop. Have you spotted the pattern there?
It sounds like you're instructing someone to do something, but not necessarily anything in particular.
It's very close. So it's not a question of instruction. For example, I'm afraid is not an instruction.
Them doing something.
Exactly. So it's called an unspecified verb. Basically, and people use this all the time. You are using a verb like I can't learn, but you're leaving out what are you talking about? So you're leaving out important information. If I say I'm afraid, what am I missing out?
What you're afraid of.
Exactly.
How much you're afraid of.
Exactly. We're leaving out quantity, we're leaving out qualities, we're leaving out objects, we're leaving out all kinds of things. Now, in a certain respect, just so you're aware of this, all verbs are unspecified because you're never fully... If I say I run quickly, I haven't told you where I'm running to. So I run quickly to the shops. Which specific shops? I run quickly to the shops which are over here. Okay, well, you're not telling me where you run from. Okay, I run quickly from my house to this shops which is over there, etc. So you notice how a verb can always be qualified more fully. So to a certain extent, it'll always be an unspecified verb, right? But we're looking really at things which are ludicrously unspecified, where they really lose meaning, where you have to start doing a lot of mind reading to try and understand what the hell they're talking about. At that point, you want to start making an intervention and challenging it.